Hello everyone, and welcome to episode 12 of the Thundercast. On today's show, we're stumbling back into the bathysphere and diving down into Rapture in anticipation of Bioshock Infinite. I'm Matthew Sorey, and joining me today I have Shane Ryan.
Now then.
And Richard Burton.
Hello.
Alright guys, so Bioshock Infinite is just around the corner now, and I think we would all agree that we're very much looking forward to it. So in anticipation of that release, we've all gone back to the original Bioshock, which was released in 2007, which I can't believe because that seems like so long ago, and it doesn't seem like yesterday since I was playing this game. So let's kick things off with a discussion of what is probably one of the most obvious talking points when you think about Bioshock. The setting, and by that I obviously mean the underwater dystopia of Rapture. So, Richard, after 5 years, how do you think Rapture holds up as a video game setting?
I think when people think about Bioshock, the first thing they think of is Rapture. Mm. Because within its walls, I think the whole ethos of the game existed, of the sort of freedom of expression and freedom of science and things like that. And I think it was very important that the designers get Rapture right above everything else. Mm-hmm. So when you see it, not only is it visually arresting, but the creative impulses that have formed it are very obvious throughout its architecture.
Ideologies behind it.
Absolutely, yeah. And when you go through the different zones, you know, you start to see the different sciences that has gone into making the individual areas, and I think nothing else in Bioshock is more important than Rapture. So even the characters that are in there, there's obviously some great ones, but none of them are as important as the surrounding themselves. So when they created it, I think it was by far the most important thing for them to do.
Well, this is something that people say very often, that like Rapture is a character in and of itself because it has so much character, and as you were saying before, it is built from the ideas that obviously Andrew Ryan, one of the lead characters, has, and the way it's constructed is as one big freedom of expression, both in the sciences and the arts. And that really, like, that really shows throughout its visual design. Like each area is like just a monument to one of those ideologies.
I can't think of another video game whose location is as integral to not just the story but also to the gameplay as Rapture. I'm racking my brains now trying to think. The closest I can come up with is probably City 17. Was it City 17?
Yeah, in
Half-Life 2.
The only other one I can think of would be the house in Resident Evil 1.
Oh, yeah.
Which I think is quite an iconic thing. I mean, you wouldn't think about it straight away because it doesn't have a name as much, but when people talk about the game, the first thing they say is mansion.
Yeah.
Is that the first thing that pops up? Like, that is pretty much a character in itself as well.
Yeah. There's been better Resident Evil game. I know we're not talking, this will be off the cuff here, but there's been better Resident Evil games, but I don't think there's been a better setting than the mansion in Resident Evil 1. I don't even think Raccoon City was as good as the mansion. It was so creepy.
Yeah, the remake on the GameCube is the best Resident Evil, but yeah, let's not sidetrack too much. So yeah, with the actual Rapture, from replaying it this week, what I like the most is, although, especially at the moment, graphics and technology, especially when it comes to 3D graphics, they don't age well. So where you can look back on 2D graphics and sprites, it has a sort of retro feel, or overall it still looks good.
Yeah.
The things with 3D graphics is they continually get worse. However, going back to this, because it has such a strong aesthetic and the way everything looks, and it's got so many like vibrant colours, it still looks good.
I think the colours are one thing that really stood out for me going back to mm-hmm. it. It had this like such a colourful game when you look at it, which I don't know, really stuck in my head after I first played it. It's really colourful, which I suppose reflects the characters that are down there in this city.
I'd definitely agree with that. I think when you look at some of the game worlds, I'm thinking of Dunwall specifically in Dishonored. When I think of Dunwall, I think of a colour, and it's a pretty sort of murky gunmetal grey. But when I think of Bioshock, all I can think of is a plethora of colours that they used. Yeah. To really give it a sense of vibrancy. Mm. I don't know whether that was a good thing or a bad thing, but it's definitely memorable.
I think at the time that it came out, it kind of stood out because you were getting a lot of those Gears of War-y type, grey, dark shooter type games, and this really stood out.
Cog was very, very grey and existent at the time.
Mm-hmm. I think it's summed up for me when I think about it graphically is the oil. Because it has a really weird kind of thick plastic look to it, and it's really kind of bright green and purple, where you know it's oil because it's those colours, even though it's far removed from any realistic colour.
Mm.
So it's like the people and the character itself, everything's exaggerated.
Yeah.
So all the colours are exaggerated, even though it wouldn't make any sense. But because it's consistent throughout all the design, it makes sense. So if this was another game like Gears of War and suddenly you had really colourful oil, you'd think, that looks a bit weird. But in this, it's just that consistency throughout in the design.
Yeah.
And it's clear that they sat down and designed Rapture before they probably thought about a lot of other things. Yeah. And the characters just made sense as they went along.
Hmm.
I think it kind of found a nice thin line between realism and cartoon, exaggerated cartooniness, if that's a word, that it needed. But it found a lovely balance.
It reminded me a lot, when I played it, of what made Fallout 1 and 2 good, in the same sort of design, where they took kind of like an old, like 40s, 50s, kind of just after post-war, like boom, where everything's dead happy, but kind of creepy. So, for example, then in Fallout you had the whole Pip-Boy thing, where it was all dead smiley, but then all the images within it were really graphic. And this did similar thing with the plasmids, where you get the short presentations of people being killed by something. And even in game, it has the kind of 50s music, that kind of post-war, everything's cheery, but it's too cheery. In the same way that people kind of get scared of clowns because they smile too much, so you feel nervous around. It's the same in this, where everything's so, it's supposed to be so great that clearly everything's not.
The surface is kind of like made to be so happy and vibrant and fantastical, but you know that underneath that surface is horrible, horrible events.
Mm-hmm. Which is pretty much what happens within the story itself.
Yeah, so it kind of fits that.
And being underwater is a huge thing as well.
Oh yeah, they really nailed that sense of time and place, but then they molded that sense of time and place into this magical setting where it's underwater. I mean, that's physically impossible with the technology of the time, I imagine. But the fact that they made it seem plausible in your head, because when I play, I don't ever really question the fact that, hang on a minute, this couldn't exist here, this shouldn't be here, what's this doing here? It's just because you are so absorbed in that environment because it's so well designed.
Definitely.
You don't think of that.
It's like what I mentioned on the, I think when we talked about Tomb Raider, which is the idea that for filmmakers, for example, they understand that they can get away with certain mistakes because the audience won't notice it if they're enjoying the film. So there might be continuity errors, but you won't notice. Mm. However, if you start to notice them, it means you're not enjoying the game. So the example of Tomb Raider, there's loads of times when I just sat back and thought, this is just nonsense. And it meant that I wasn't involved as much as I should have been.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in this, I'm underwater running around, injecting myself, throwing lightning bolts everywhere. But I never think for a second, oh, this is ridiculous. Because I'm totally absorbed in that kind of crazy, cartoonish world.
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think I think everyone, if you were to pick one moment that I don't know whether it encapsulates it, but the way you enter Rapture is from the lighthouse, which is probably one of my favourite first half hours in a video game. Where you come into this lighthouse and it slowly starts to dawn on you what's going on and the the idea behind the city and you, your entrance into the city. And then when you get there, I remember one of the early scenes is there's a load of suitcases everywhere, stacked up to the ceiling of suitcases, and it's quite clear that everyone has desperately been trying to get out of this place, but not being able to, and are now running around like maniacs, killing each other. And it was that sense. It was like a real sort of sense of terror. And then after, almost immediately after that, you got that great scene where there was that woman, and all you could see was a shadow.
Oh yeah,
and she was like singing a lullaby to a pram, and you know you kind of. I can't remember if she attacks you and you kill her.
I think there's a gun.
Big old revolver in there.
Brilliant. So right. Good.
I think what you're talking about. Yeah, it's people often talk about how games can be used as a storytelling medium, and I think that first half hour really demonstrates that the team that made this game really know how to use video games as a storytelling medium, because Rapture, the environment itself, tells its own story. You're kind of looking at those things, like you said. You looked at those suitcases, and they're all just left there, and things are crumbling around you
as well. Andrew Ryan being a, like, I can't remember, but you know, they were. It was, I knew what was going on. In the first half hour, and that's a really hard thing to do. When you know, I know it's kind of controlled a little bit by the game, because you pick up the radio and you're listening to. You know, a kind of a bit of back history, but more than anything, it's what you're seeing that's sort of leading you by the hand, as opposed to what the game is telling you is happening. I can't get my head around how difficult that must be to do.
And they never take the control away from you as well. No. So the cheap thing to do is, when you're designing something, is to think, how do we make this? Oh, you know what? Just scrap all the control of the player. We'll take over, so we make sure they see exactly what we want them to do.
Yeah.
Because if they don't, they're not going to enjoy our world. Whereas this clearly proves it's the opposite, where if it's like Valve do in Half-Life, if it's interesting enough, you'll stick around.
Yeah, exactly.
And you won't start crouching and trying to swing crowbar about at somebody while they're talking.
Yeah.
And there's tools that you can use whilst you're in game to draw people's attention, draw people's eyes, direct them towards things that 2K did really well this game. Yeah. I mean, like, think about how many developers would have opened this game with a cutscene explaining the backstory of Rapture.
Yep. And think how many QuickTime events you would have had in the first hour if they'd made it this year.
That would have killed it.
When the water's coming through the tunnels, it would be constant, press X, press X, press X. Oh no, start again. Now you just walk forward. Because that's what you'd do.
I mean, you are directed. It is a very directed opening sequence. Mm-hmm. Like, there's not much freedom. And when you get later on into the game, areas kind of open up a little bit. They're not entirely linear. But it works so well, even though you are so directed, because you have all these amazing things to see, and all these crazy things are happening to you. But you still have that element of control, which was something really that I'd only experienced in, say, Half-Life, when I actually played the original Bioshock. So it left like a massive impression on me.
We've mentioned Half-Life about three or four times.
I think it's inevitable when you talk about the opening of Bioshock, because it's so inspired by that opening of Half-Life, where you're riding through into Black Mesa and you have control, and you see all of these things that suggest the story to you, just as you do when you're going down in the bathysphere, going down to Rapture for the first time.
I think it's at that a certain amount of braveness in what is essentially a first-person shooter game. I think after a while you come to realize that it's probably not fair to call it a shooter, in so much as it's more of an action game, I suppose. But it's a brave thing to not, you know, give someone a gun and point them towards the enemy and go, there you go, you know, knock yourself out. But to slowly reveal things about the game before you give them the chance to shoot stuff is a remarkably brave thing to do, and I don't think many developers at the time would have done that. It's just, again, the same with Half-Life. It took you ages before you got a gun and you could start popping caps in people. And even now it's not done very often. I think people expect a first person shooting game you're going to start, you know, dropping people in the first 10 seconds.
Yeah.
But it's not if you do that, it's definitely going to lose any form of punctuation or any form of, you know, suspense or surprise it's going to have.
I think part of that is when you're, the way the brain kind of works, where if you, same with a film, when you kind of boot up a film and you sit back or you're in a cinema and you get that first kind of opening shot and the music, it kind of instantly sets the pace. And you kind of lock into that then. Like, for example, I watched a film recently called The Hunter.
Mm.
And as soon as it started, for about 10 seconds, I was like, right, I know exactly what kind of film, pace-wise and tone, this is going to be.
Yeah.
And it's a case of kind of slowing down and just getting into it.
Yeah.
So when it's like a video game, like Richard's saying, with guns, and it starts and it's just explosion, 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 press X, guns. It's, and then if it tries to then step back, you're just going to get bored.
Yeah, definitely.
Because it started off so quick, and by just starting off a little slower, but keeping it interesting, it means you get way more involved, and you'll start, and then you're getting that kind of mindset, and you'll yourself, again, try and stop. And the amount of times when you play this, and because I've been replaying it, I've found so much more story hidden away when you go off the beaten track.
Yeah.
And you find out extra little bits and pieces to, like, this family photo that keeps flashing up, and how other people have been involved with other characters, and how, you know, you can tell things have been on a decline for a while.
Mm.
So even though the main kind of antagonist, Andrew Ryan, he's kind of the head guy who's leading it all, and he kind of talks about all his ideas, it's this whole thing of he's still human himself, so there's these little bits that play up throughout it, but you have to kind of go out the way to find it.
Mm.
And I always prefer stuff like that. In the modern gaming, it would be, for example, more thing of, oh, go get this for an achievement. Whereas in this, you go out of your way to get it because you want to find out about it.
Yeah, because it's so interesting.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, this is something that Dishonored did quite well, actually. Like, in the hub area in Dishonored, there's actually quite a lot of not sealed off, but secret locations that you can get to as you get further powers, that you don't have to go to at all, but you can if you just feel like exploring, and you'll come across little incidental bits of narrative, little maybe audiobooks or maybe books or just something painted on the wall that says something about the world or says something about the characters.
There was secret areas are really, really empowering, and I don't understand why they're pretty much completely removed, especially in first-person shooters. If I think back to playing Doom when that first came out and finding the first secret level in the first episode, and it still sticks with me now, the whole idea of figuring it out and being transported to this whole new level because you'd done this whole bit and found it out, and that just is totally a miss now, where it's just, even in Call of Duty, if they had it where in one of the levels you just went off a side alley and the door actually opened and you got like a side bit. And it played out and it went back on. Just little things like that.
Didn't they try something like that in the most recent Black Ops 2? Could you vary the ends or something? I didn't play it.
I think so, but I've not played it, but I believe that's still based within the main thing. It's just what happens within the levels then dictates what changes.
I constantly bash Call of Duty, as some of you may have noticed, but my video game shelf is full of Call of Duty titles. So this time I thought, you know what? Practice what you preach, Murphy. Let's not buy Call of Duty. And I'm quite proud of it. And I've still not bought it.
Mm.
I'm not going to. I'm going to sit around and play Bioshock all day.
That's personal growth there, Richard.
I think I've achieved a great deal through not spending £40 on something I've already played 7 times. I think that says a lot about me. And I'm very happy about it.
Brilliant.
Which is what's good about what these guys do, because if you think about the team, I know the name of the team's changed and some people would have come and gone, but from doing System Shock 2 to starting a brand new thing with Bioshock, from then moving completely onto Bioshock Infinite, which is kind of, they're kind of keeping the Bioshock name, I'm guessing, in the way they would have liked to have kept System Shock, where from then they probably would have branched out into completely different stories, but keep it under this kind of umbrella. So that it doesn't get lost, and probably to stop people doing sequels that we don't want them to do as well.
Okay, guys, so we'll take a quick break here, and we'll be back in a second with a further discussion of the game story. Welcome back, guys. So let's continue talking about the story of the game. Shane, would you kindly give me some of your opinions on BioShock's narrative?
There's two parts to it that I like from when I think about what it means, and what I also think is very clever about it. As an example, is in a lot of, for example, American film and other video games and literature and media, it'll always try and explain everything. So you can't have something happen and it not be fully explained. So, for example, when they remake an Eastern film, that, for example, something happens in it just because, or somebody's a ghost just because, you instead have to create some massive backstory about some kid that listened to metal and got bullied at school and it just ruins it all. Whereas with this, I feel that it's all about the questions, and then it's up to you whether you think, for example, what Andrew Ryan was trying to achieve was the right thing, and whether it was just the fact that people abused the idea of it. And it reminded me a lot of essentially what Nietzsche, the philosopher, the German one, wrote about a lot. So in the book, The Lust Spoke Zarathustra, which is basically about the idea that, it's a mistranslation, but the superhuman, the idea that he moves away from civilization and basically eventually travels up to a hill and moves away from people to say, you know, you need to become better than this, because essentially God is dead, so we need to be more than just animals trying to attack each other. And I felt that a lot of Rapture in the story of what happens there is essentially kind of a time lock down to when people move away from civilization under the idea of, instead of rather than Nietzsche, it's Andrew Ryan, of him saying, right, we can be better, you know, because it even talks about it throughout, saying the difference between man and a parasite is man is essentially God. He creates, a parasite leeches off what a man creates, which is really similar sort of conversation. It's the idea of, was Andrew Ryan right? And it's just the fact that everyone else in the building, the place, was a parasite and went too far. Because if you think about him, he's not as fucked up as the rest of the people living there, who are just like, literally pretty much falling to bits. And the idea that the perfect is the enemy of the good, the idea that these people are trying to strive to be perfect and end up kind of incombusted and becoming these animals, worse than human.
They kind of go too far and go over the edge.
Exactly. Yeah. Come back round and basically just running around trying to kill each other like animals again.
Yeah. But that's a very good point. Like, it's definitely a game about ideas in terms of its story. Like, Andrew Ryan is a man, he's an industrialist, and he's got a very capitalistic ideology about how the world should be. No gods or whatever that phrase is, I can't remember what it is. No gods, only men, I think, or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he's very anti-religion as well. He's very much that kind of person. And I can't remember any other game that's really presented a character that's about some kind of philosophical ideology about human life, the way that we should live our lives.
I think Duke Nukem was pretty philosophical.
Well, obviously Duke Nukem as well. That's another one of the great examples.
A failure would be Far Cry 3.
I think if Nietzsche was around today, he'd be all about Duke Nukem.
Duke Nukem.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
Like, throwing the shit at the wall really says something about the human condition.
Yeah, I never...
In a way.
Yeah, crashing on...
Although, to be fair, you don't get a gun in that game for the first hour.
You just...
No one ever mentions. And I thought, well, that's in the game. But anyway, back to the story. In this one, it is very much about the ideas. And that's... And again, through playing through it, is you get these interactions and you find these audio logs, which is... What I find really clever, and I wish more games would do, is that you get these audio logs and you play them while you're in-game and you're moving about, and they're optional. So it's not, the game doesn't stop. You don't have to go into some interactive menu where the game pauses just to sit there and read some boring text. It just, everything, there's no text. Everything's spoken in-game when you want it. And I don't understand why so many other games force you to press start and scroll through some boring text, and people don't really get into that.
That is complements BioShock's quite fast gameplay, but I don't mind reading so much in say like Skyrim, which as I read somewhere, the amount of literature you can read and what it would equate to to like reading 5 novels or something daft like that. I don't mind that, because Skyrim is something to take your time over and something where you can sit down and have a read.
Do you not think it'd be quite good in Skyrim if you got certain ones that were red, and you could, as you're walking around in an area, you could, for example, press a button and it would play the book about that area, and it'd have a narration as you're just strolling about.
I don't know. That kind of doesn't work within the confines of the world. Like, what would you be hearing that through? Unless it was some kind of magic that you could hear. Magic that kind of explains
dragons.
It, I suppose. Magic.
I know, as long as it's the same narrator. It's just like a story. It's just like a film then, isn't it? Where you don't see the narrator.
But I suppose so, yeah.
Presume the god. They're just a guy chatting.
I mean, I didn't, like, I gave up on reading books in Skyrim just because I thought it was so boring, to be honest with you. I didn't really come across many interesting stories, but...
I really took my time over Skyrim. I've still not completed it. And it's been almost, like, 2 years? Maybe less? I don't know. But okay, I just keep dipping back to it. I'll finish it eventually, maybe. But I'm quite happy just having it there and going back and having a read and, I don't know, smithing stuff. And I quite like cooking and all that jazz. I was thinking about giving up dragon hunting and getting a job as a blacksmith or something.
Just being a chef.
Oh, yeah. That would be a dream. In a big castle. Anyway.
Yeah, back to the audio logs. they're a really good way to tell the story. Like, they give you so much more of the background of Rapture than you would have got if you had just a traditional narrative that was told through cutscenes and you didn't have anything else. And coming back to something you said before, Shane, you said there's no text. That's not strictly true. Like, BioShock was probably not one of the first games. Obviously, Half-Life and Half-Life 2 did this before. But one of the first games where it had lots of text on the wall and the text actually meant something. So there's places that you walk into and you'll see lots of things written in blood on the wall, and they're relevant to the area that you're in.
That was how they gave the big
reveal.
Reveal away. It came in a little room, and I remember it being scrawled on the wall. And then you had that brilliant realization of you've been played for an absolute mug because you've been playing video games all your life. It was so good. I don't think there's not been many sort of video game twists as good as that one, because it kind of made you look at the medium and it made you rethink the way you engage with games, because you've just been doing what that guy said because he's been saying it, you know, just because you felt, I don't know, maybe like you need someone to lead you around a video game as opposed to going and exploring it yourself. I know you were kind of stuck on one track, but you still found yourself being led by the hand into, you know, essentially your own doom.
The reason why it's such a great twist is that it has so many layers. Like, it is a commentary on how we play video games and how video games are designed and what they are as a medium. Yeah. And it also works within the confines of the story that's being told. I won't go into too much detail, obviously. Don't want to give spoilers away.
No. So the only other game that's been close to that, which became more of a meta thing, was recently Hotline Miami. And if you're considering it's been 5 or 6 years. I've not played it, but Spec Ops, I think, did it in a similar sort of way. But it's not as much as you'd expect of games kind of looking or using the idea that the player's used to certain things and using it against them.
It's almost a fourth wall breaking kind of thing, where the game is making a commentary about itself and about the medium, but without breaking the actual game itself, without breaking out of the story of the game or setting or anything.
It wasn't as explicit as Metal Gear Solid, which constantly sort of tapped on the fourth wall quite a bit. It was a lot more subtle, and it didn't go so far as to saying, you know, why did you do that? In so much as you sort of asking yourself, why did I do that? It was very, it was for a reveal that size and a reveal that clever, I thought it was very subtle, which is just a testament to the confidence that the designers had that people would engage so much with the title.
It's definitely a high level of integrity of this team sitting down and doing this. There's no pandering to, oh, what if 40% of the audience don't get it? It's just, well, you know, we'll ask the question, we'll put it in. If they're not bothered, they'll just shoot everything else. But, you know, the rest of the audience will get it. They'll appreciate it. You can't aim for 100% of everyone all the time. Otherwise, ideas like this just don't happen.
Definitely.
I thought.
I mean, it obviously sunk in because I have a T-shirt that says "A man chooses, a slave obeys." Because I'm that cool.
I'd like to see that. Which again,
very Nietzsche.
Mm.
There's even well, I was playing it before earlier today. There's when you pick up a audio log in a side room, it's Ryan talking about the kind of the parasite and the man thing, which is again very similar to what Nietzsche talked about in the book I mentioned, which he talks about kind of man and maggot and the idea that there's two, what the two things are. It's very, very, very close. There's two other things I kind of want to mention. One's kind of a side piece, and it's the use of music. So often throughout the game, there's no music whatsoever. There's no kind of thumping drums like a Brian Taylor kind of Rambo soundtrack that every video game seems to happen at the have at the moment. It's just like dum 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 under everything.
That very much Halo kind of shooter design.
Yeah, well, kind of Halo actually had quite a good design, but I was thinking more like Gears of War had it. Tomb Raider.
No, had Tomb Raider didn't have drums, did it? Oh, wait, it was all drums.
Yeah, just constant pounding, dum dum. It's really kind of primitive, simplistic. Kind of cheap, just yeah, get it easy to do quickly, gets people excited, but it doesn't last. Whereas with this, there's very clever kind of string classical arrangements that seep in and out on main events, and it has much more impact because you don't realize there was no music. And when you have kind of the big daddy things walking around in kind of these giant underwater suits with drills, and you can hear them stomping and groaning around, that kind of becomes. Again, it's Rapture is the sound of it all creaking rather than having a soundtrack that doesn't make any sense when you come across something and there's like an old record player and it's got a 50s song that you can play on it. And it kind of makes it, again, it's that thing where it's creepy, but it shouldn't be, but it is. It's kind of that happy kind of post-war song, but it's really not at the same time. It's kind of a dark side to it.
It's creepy because it's giving like a false picture of what is in there. But yeah, speaking about like sound design and music coming, I think one of the nicest bits of music is when you choose to save a little sister. There's a nice bit of music that comes in there, like really, really sad strings in the background of it. I can't actually remember what the sound for when you actually choose to kill a little sister is. Because I haven't done
that
in this playthrough.
Don't tell me you've not killed a little sister. Everyone's killed at least one.
Oh yeah. The first two playthroughs of this game. Yeah, I did. Yeah, but I just thought now I'd try. See if I could go without.
The first little sister in the first playthrough I did, and then after that I thought I'm not doing that again, and then went down the rescue route. But that's my second point actually. That whole harvest rescue situation, which is such again. When you think about it on paper, that's just a small thing, but they make it such an important part. Again, it's optional. It ties into what I guess is two endings, essentially, or kind of several endings, depending upon those kind of choices. Yeah. I think they're only small differences. But again, I think the reward you get in game, which in theory, as a pure video game, the reward you get should be more important. But because it's so well designed, and put together and constructed, it's the choice you make that I feel is more important when you're playing it. So it's whether you, when your playthrough, whether it's what you do or whether you're role playing as this character that's stuck in this underwater city, whether you harvest or rescue, I think is more of the choice rather than just in most games. It's, oh, what gives me the best weapon? So in this, for example, you get better stuff for harvesting. Or so you're told kind of as you go through. But I always think of the way people pick it. It's kind of like a personality thing as you go through of whether you're just gonna rescue the little sisters because it feels like the right thing to do to you, or the harvest them because you just need to get whatever you need to do to get the job done.
Yeah, I would almost disagree slightly. I don't think there's enough punishment. You don't feel like you're losing out enough. Having done it both ways, I didn't feel like I was losing out a hell of a lot by saving the little sisters. And the game kind of tells you that, oh, you save these, you'll be worse off. And you still get quite a lot of Adam, enough to complete the game, enough to play through the game, enough to do it quite, not easily, but like be comfortable, if you will.
Do you think if they made it, like, the Adam was so imperative to...
Where you were really kind of punishing yourself to do this, but you felt like you had to do it because it was the right thing. And there's another part to this whole morality system where I didn't really feel like you had a good enough payoff for your choices, because it is essentially just a different cutscene that you get at the end of the game, depending upon which route you took, whether to save the little sisters or to kill the little sisters for more Adam. there's not that kind of like in-game impact, if you
I
will.
Would
it's just
agree
different...
outside of this game for other games, but if they punished you too much here, it would go back to the... That would be them answering their own question, if that makes sense. Mm. The whole setup to me, in what happens throughout this, is always they're asking the question of the player, what do you think about this? What, and leaving it at that. Whereas if they heavily punished you either way, then that would be them making a stance on it. I know there's a slight change at the end, but I think any more than that, and they would be answering that question, which might affect it too much.
Mm, that's true. It's just when I think about morality systems now, and having played The Walking Dead recently, like that your choices that you made there, whether you chose to kill or save someone, that really had an impact on the gameplay and the way that the game unfolded as you went along. And I would have kind of liked that, not exactly that kind of system, but something that had as much of an impact within BioShock. I didn't really feel like it
more
had...
of an in-game change rather than outside of it and how you felt about it.
Yeah, because I felt like the in-game change was actually very minimal. It didn't make that much of a difference.
One of the I don't know whether you can call it cheap, but it would have made kind of made sense that if you didn't harvest the little sisters, you didn't get any of the cool sort of transformations to your body, so you couldn't use sort of plasmids, and you were just reliant on firearms. And then that way, it felt like you were making such a concession towards morality, or like having a positive sort of outlook on the game and not killing the little sisters. You would be losing out such a huge amount. I think that would have really questioned you whether you want like to be able to fire bees out your hands for killing a little girl.
I think their concern again would be whether people then would make too much of a choice based upon the in-game, solely on that rather than
solely on what you would be losing out from.
It comes down to whether, because to me, I think that rescue harvest thing is a kind of an external. It's how you feel outside of the game rather than what's inside it. So if they did put too much pressure on, or again, I agree, in another game, I think that would be a good idea where they could play with that, you know, as you become, like Mass Effect, if they kept to the idea of as you become more of an arse, you basically become harder, which they never really went with, and it didn't really make, you just got this kind of scars, but they should have really transformed you to the point where you become, you know, you essentially become harder or bulkier because of it, and has an in-game effect. But I think then that might come back to people just solely playing it because they want to get that gun or they want to get that plasmid rather than... I'm guessing this was probably what they sat down and discussed a lot, and the ideas as to why they didn't do it. Because I'm sure they must have thought about, you know, how much should we punish people for this?
That's true. Yeah. But then I would almost question why they did it, because it does have a small gameplay impact depending upon whether you choose to kill the little sisters or save the little sisters. I kind of think if they almost removed that and made it purely narrative, then you would have approached it as a morality choice, just as what you would do in real life, because that's generally how I like to play those kind of things. But the fact that it does have a gameplay impact kind of, I imagine, will drive quite a lot of players down one route or the other. And I didn't feel like the gameplay impact was strong enough to really make the decision impactful in a way.
Yeah. So you're saying basically should have gone one way or the other, where you harvest or rescue, but you get nothing either way, or you get everything either way.
Yeah, it kind of felt like too much of a middle ground for me.
That would have really tested me, I think, because I played it through a couple of times, and I think both times I rescued the little sisters because I'm just an absolute sweetheart. But I think if you'd have said, you know, oh, if you harvest them, you know, you get super cool powers. And you're pretty much invincible badass, but you feel powerful all the same. I'd have harvest them, you know. I want the bees, you know. So
yeah, say they'd scrap the difficulty level, and then it just locked you down into this. And if it kind of had an auto save, no going back thing, so rather than you being able to buy plasmids every time you harvest somebody, you got a new power.
That would have been
the only way you could get it.
That would have been absolutely badass. That would have really tested people. And then somehow you have to reward them heavily at the end for like saving all the little.
Yeah,
little
definitely. Yeah,
I don't know how you'd do that.
I don't know. It's a very hard thing to to try and tell someone or come up with a way to how and do it. It's something that game designers will have to think about for a hell of a long time.
I think it'd work elsewhere, but again, it comes back to the point of if they had too many endings, again, they're answering their own questions then, aren't they? If whether everyone was right and whether Andrew Ryan was right and stuff like that.
Mm.
And I just think then that kind of... the story might not have the lasting appeal that it does if it kind of tried to close it off too much.
Mm.
I mean, again, it still does it to some extent by having two slight different endings. But I can't remember how much of a narrative change that actually makes, or whether it's just like a 20 seconds.
In terms of the ending, it does. It is just a 30-second cutscene, but the cutscenes are quite different in what happens in those cutscenes.
Is Rapture still the same, though, isn't it? Is it not just to do with what happens to you?
Yeah.
I can't recall. It's been a while since I've seen him.
It's to do with what happens to the little sisters.
Right, okay.
I remember...
And you as well.
Oh, of course, yeah. It's just flashback.
No spoilers here, by the way. I remember... No. Now, someone... this is really, really going back. I had Lotus... Is it Lotus Esprit Challenge or something on the Amiga? Literally 20 years ago, I had this game. What is it? Lotus Elan Challenge? Lotus Challenge? Something like that. Anyway, it was a bit of an Outrun clone, but I always found it really hard to play. But when I got to the end of it, years and years after its release date, it gave me a code, and I found out if I sent this code off to the developers, they send you a prize, a physical prize. I think it was a T-shirt or something like that. Someone's going to have to validate that, because I can't quite remember. But I thought, you know, what an amazing thing. Obviously, they could do it back then because only 5 or 6 people played the game. But wouldn't it be awesome if you'd got through Rapture without harvesting one little sister? You got a code and you could send off and get a T-shirt that said, I'm not a child killer or something like that.
Yeah, I saved the little sisters.
I saved the little sister, and each code was individual. I think that would be an incredible gesture. I think they should do that for...
Mm-hmm. They did that with some Commodore 64 games, like kind of like puzzle games, and if you solve the puzzle and then sent off the answer, the first person to get it. And there's another one as well where there's kind of a map within it of where something was hidden in the real world within England.
God.
And I'm sure it's like if you play it within the game, you could figure out where something was buried, but no one ever figured it out.
Oh my God, let's get it and find it.
I think the developers just dug it up, but it's stuff like that, which I think...
It was an ET cartridge.
I think back then, that was in the 80s, on 8-bit machines, and they were thinking about bleeding the inside, like the out, you know, both worlds together, video game, and how it can interrupt the other. And since then, it's got a bit... I guess it's just because big publishers don't want to touch that stuff because it's too much bother, and they're just like, right, just keep the chain moving. But I think developers, especially when you've got ones... like this now, where you've got only a few developers left that can make these sort of decisions. It would have been nice to do something. I mean, really, now it would just be an avatar item for your 360 or something, wouldn't it? Like a special T-shirt. But,
I'm sure there'll be achievements you can unlock in the 360 version of Infinite that give you an avatar T-shirt or something. Give you a cap.
I want a real T-shirt.
Yeah.
I want something. I want a poster or something, or a hat. Something that I can wear and people will know that I have achieved something.
Get a Big Daddy outfit.
A Big Daddy outfit. I'd wear that to work with
plushie. That'd be great. It'd
be fabulous. All right, guys. We'll take another quick break and then we'll be back with a discussion about the gameplay of Bioshock. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. So we're going to have a discussion about the gameplay of Bioshock now. So people often cite gameplay as probably the weakest part of Bioshock, considering how strong like its setting and its narrative is. And I suppose from purely a shooting mechanics perspective, it does feel a little clunky, a little stiff. But I think it really comes into its own when you take in like the RPG elements of its design. So Shane, what do you think of Bioshock's gameplay?
I agree with both points, and the closest kind of connection I could make recently would be Metro 2033,
mm-hmm.
where it's the world dictates how the guns work. So in this, for example, you don't run around with a machine gun. It's not dead accurate. Even when you kind of power it up, it's still not, you know, great. And in a lot of games now, people just want to, I don't know, like no scope headshots and all that nonsense, or run around with an AK-47 just blowing absolutely everything away. And the game also starts off quite hard. So yeah, when you first start off, even on normal, you can die quite easily, especially when you've versus some of the bigger creatures and they can take you out in two hits. Which again is, it actually makes you feel more powerful as you go through, as you get more plasmids, as you, essentially there's different, you can upgrade your engineering for hacking and security, you can upgrade your defense, your combat. All these extra little things all start to come into play. And from this second playthrough now I'm doing, where I'm actually taking my time with the photography. So you, if you've not played it, you essentially get an old camera. And when you, if you take photos of the enemy, the better the photo, the more research you do on them. And every time you level up the research, you either do more damage or you basically gain one of their abilities to use. And now I've been doing that. It's made such a massive difference that I've got the plasmid where if you don't move, you become invisible, which is really handy when you're being chased, or if they're all coming through a door, you just stand there, turn invisible, and they'll just get confused. And then you can throw a grenade in and off the rock, well, the rocket launcher anyway.
I've done exactly the same. I never used the camera in my first two playthroughs that I originally did, but I'm using it now, and it's quite interesting to see what skills and abilities you actually get if you take your time to take pictures of these enemies, and you actually go about like setting up these pictures and not just diving into the combat straight away. I mean, it's quite an interesting element of the game that doesn't really get talked about that often. And I think cameras should be in more games, really, because like I can only think of this and Beyond Good and Evil, where you've had a camera, and they've both had quite well designed implementations of it. Where if you take pictures of certain things in the games, you get a reward for doing that, for taking the time to do that. But it's also quite satisfying in some way. I don't know why. Maybe it's because it's niche. Maybe it's because it's something that's never really been done before in games.
There's a Japanese horror game I never played, Fatal Frame or something, that based its whole game upon it. But for this is, again, but that's the whole idea of that game is based upon that. Whereas this is an addition to the
Metal Gear had a
camera.
Yeah, you could take photos of ghosts of the production crew. They were hidden around the hidden around the game, and they weren't visible until you started taking a photo of them. And I remember doing that for an ungodly amount of time. but yeah, that was kind of. You could also take photos of the nudie girls, and Snake would say something hilarious about them. So yeah, but I agree with the. Taking photos of it was awkward to do, but it required it needed to be awkward because you were defenseless while you were doing it.
But it has a nice like reward loop, like you get that feedback where enemies take extra damage and you unlock new tonics and things to yourself, which is quite interesting.
Same with the upgrades for the weapons. If you stick on the track and you don't explore in the little mini hubs or go into the side rooms, you miss a lot of the weapon upgrades.
Yeah.
And rather than it being in a lot of games where you've got like 5 tiers on a weapon, this is just shotgun, extra damage. And when you level that up, you can take a lot of things down in 1 or 2 shots then. And it makes a massive difference. And if you're just running around playing it as a purely linear game, never going off that beaten path, then you're going to miss that, and as you go through, you're probably going to think, oh, these weapons are rubbish. And it actually makes it, again, it's a thing that hardly gets talked about, but they made it work. But again, what I liked is they never forced you to do it.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, there wasn't like a giant arrow saying, go here and upgrade this weapon, because we realise if you don't, you're going to struggle. It's just, well, if you don't go and find it, then tough luck.
I think the gameplay, for me, I didn't quite understand why people weren't over, well, I can kind of understand, because you're right, it is a bit clunky and it's not quite as tight, but it had a certain, because you could go back to areas, it had a certain amount of sandbox elements to it, which was great. You go back to an early area that you really struggled with a bevy of powerful plasmids, you just feel like Chuck Norris striding through and sending fireballs, and I think you could get really creative with how you tackled enemies.
I think there's two different elements that we're talking about. There's kind of like the actual like mechanical aiming and things like that, and movement and things. They're slightly clunky. Yeah. I think that's probably just a result of it being maybe it being on Unreal Engine 3.5. I don't know.
It's partly on purpose as well.
Yeah, I would agree with you.
Try to make it chunky with the way that it's somebody moving rather than just this camera that's floating around at 100 miles an hour. Like you can't run. I don't think you can. No, you can't.
No, you're always
jogging. So you don't run out of breath, but you just kind of move around. You can't sprint.
I think there's...
So yeah, you've got those mechanical elements, but then you also have the RPG element to combat, which I think is really good. That's really deep. Like, it allows you to kind of customize the kind of player you want to be. Like, I love being able to hack things, and you can get all of those tonics, which are kind of like...
Slows down.
Yeah. Kind of like boosts your abilities, so you can get tonics that slow the hacking process down to make it easier and all sorts of things like that. And then, of course, you've got the plasmids, which are another integral part of the game, which I think are really nice because they feed into part of the story of the game.
Was it the sequel where you could dual-wield plasma? I never played the second one.
It was.
And you could also have guns at the same time. I think that really opened up a lot of creativity towards how you approach combat. And I think a lot of the enemies were also in context-sensitive areas, and the environment, you could use the environment against them. So there was like guys that were stood in water, you could charge up the water with electricity, or there was guys stood in petrol, you know, obviously
not too bright, but there was different
ways to engage with the surroundings. And destroy hordes. And obviously, hacking robots was great because you turning robots against each other is obviously a highlight in everyone's career. So
yeah, what I really want to do is just, especially for people listening that maybe haven't played it or it's been a while, is just stress how sandboxed the combat is.
Yeah.
So if this was another game, it would be you walk through a small path and. The AI, this is really good, but we'll come back to that in a second. Another game, the AI currently in modern games is crap, and they would just stand there and wait for you to electrocute them. Or it would be set up, or there'd be somebody sat having a sandwich on a red barrel that just blows up. Whereas in this, although you said before the stud in the water or the stud by the fire, they're probably not, and you've got to lure them in, or there'll be water running out of a pipe, and if you run back and get them through it, so there's never a bit where you... Unless it's early on, because it's trying to... What it does well in game is it basically when you get a power up, you'll usually walk straight into a situation where it's kind of set up for you to understand how it works. But then after that, it opens up all the time. And it's really clever how you'll go into one area, for example, where I've done full research on these splicer creatures, which is basically the people with the knives that crawl around.
Mm.
And there's all this water running down the stairs. And all I did when they all piled into this room was because I'd been moving, I was hidden. And all I did was have anti-personnel like ammo on my machine gun, fireballed them, and just quickly ran back up the stairs, shot them all, killed them all. And for a lot of other people, I remember playing that the first time, and that was really difficult because I hadn't researched or thought about the plasmids I was using. I was trying to run around with a shotgun like it was, you know, Doom or Duke Nukem or something, and it doesn't work like that. You need to use a combination of both of them to get through.
I mean,
that's the thing. It really does let you customize the kind of player you want to be. Like, you can choose to have all of your upgrades. Like, you can put all of your upgrades into... You can be a silent walker, so enemies can't hear you, and then you can have an upgrade that makes, like, your wrench hit really powerful if the enemy is unaware that you're there. So you can pretty much focus on melee if you want all the way through, if you choose to be that kind of player.
Yep.
And I think what you were saying about the kind of sandbox design of combat is really interesting, because I kind of, like, often hack into... security in an area, like hack all of the turrets and the cameras, and then I will draw enemies into that area, and then just let the turrets and the cameras and the security system do my fighting.
You're pretty callous.
Just because it's pretty
callous. I wouldn't want to come across you in a dark alley with lots of robots.
Well, if you see me, just don't follow me out of the alley.
I'll make sure not to. No.
Yeah, if there's any gun turrets hanging around outside Tesco's, then just avoid it.
There is gun turrets hanging out around Tesco's in my area.
Well, there you go, Matt. That's your profession.
Yeah.
Damn it. Yeah. I'll have to get hacking.
And another thing...
I've got to say, I was fucking sick of the hacking by the end of it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. I was sick of hacking.
If they needed
well.
One tonic, it would have to be auto-hack, yeah. Which is like yes. a level 3, which is you just go over, you press it, and he goes, go on, then you can have that.
Yeah, that box. And it was... You could do it so much, because you could hack all the terminals and all the sort of... The
vending machines and everything.
The cameras, bots.
God, it just... By the end of it, I was sick to high heaven of it.
That's probably, which says a lot about the game, but that's probably my biggest gripe with the game, is just that the hacking is just utterly repetitive throughout.
They were the same puzzles as well, weren't they?
Yeah. Mm. So there's slight randomization, but it was the pipe, because it's, again, if for those that don't know, it's very similar to, reminds me a bit of like Power Droid 90, and in a way, kind of reminds me of the early hacking things of old games where you have kind of, pipes and you have to get the water flowing through. It's essentially, well, it's supposed to be electricity, but it's kind of like a water pipe.
Yeah.
So basically it's the same layout pretty much every time. So for example, with security cameras, there's like two templates. There's two templates for other things, but usually you get like a few broken panels in between, but that's it.
It's based on tiles and you have to uncover those tiles, and then underneath those tiles, there'll be different shapes of pipes.
So it works at first, but again, I think once you're halfway, two thirds, if you've been leveling up your hacking, it should just auto hack.
Yeah, I
would agree, yeah. I think the problem with it is that it doesn't really change throughout the game. I think if there was some kind of like advancement in that system, if it changed up, if it became more difficult and kind of like progressed with your like hacking abilities, then it would have been more interesting and you would have
seen the hacking development in Deus Ex Human Revolution, the new one. That was fantastic. I didn't get bored of it. I quite liked it because it became more of a challenge as it grew, but
exactly, yeah, and it was an interesting mini game in and of itself, and it felt just difficult enough to like I don't know like to actually be a slight barrier, but then it wasn't difficult enough so that you could do so many of them and you would actually get the reward for doing that.
I think I did
find it a barrier as well. You know, I on some of them I just had to give up. Well, not particularly smart, but you know, it was. It was good. You did have to focus on it as well. And
I think with any mini game that like that, that's about unlocking something, there's got to be some kind of risk reward. Mm. And I found that like even in the more difficult ones, more difficult hacking mini games in BioShock, I found them all quite easy. Really,
yeah.
I found it quite easy to hack. I didn't like, so I wasn't getting punished for hacking. Really,
did it set an alarm?
Whereas
off?
I think there should be some kind of balance. Yeah, no. It sets an alarm off, and you get.
I'm sure. Did you not just take a little bit of damage?
I think it depends what you're hacking.
Yeah, it definitely does that, yeah.
Yeah, I think it depends on what you're hacking. Oh, so okay. If you're hacking like a vending machine, then yeah, it gives you a little bit of electrical damage. But if you're hacking a security system, then yeah, I think it sends turrets after you.
Well, that just gives an example of the fact I never failed the security system once. It's just more of a chore.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
Exactly, yeah.
So the other thing I wanted to mention, which really stands up for me considering how old it is, I mentioned it just before, was the AI of the enemy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the way that some of them will just sprint at you, and it's not just character types or classes that do the same things. Others will run out of doors and disappear. Some will just be walking around. Sometimes you might even get two fighting randomly, or they'll run down and run past you to something else.
Yeah.
And I really like how, even if you get further in the game, sometimes you're still surprised, or you'll turn around and you'll find that you've been kind of flanked. By one or two of them.
Someone's randomly entered or something.
Yeah, especially when you go back through.
I really liked how the game kind of has its own ecosystem. It's a very simple ecosystem, and I wish it was a little deeper. But there is that ecosystem of like the big daddies and little sisters just exist in these levels, and they're going about their business, doing their own thing. Little sisters going around harvesting dead bodies, and then you get these splicers who are just wandering around as well. And you can there's some situations that you come across that just happen organically, where a splicer will walk into a room and the big daddy's there, and the splicer will decide to attack the little sister. So then you'll get this fight evolve between the big daddy and the splicer that's completely organic, which I thought was really nice. Like it's a very simple ecosystem, as I said, but. It's something different. You don't get that in every game. Lots of games, it's just throw enemies at you. But to see enemies fight amongst themselves was quite interesting.
I think it's good that it's not even the main point of the game, is that the AI is quite good. They've just actually thought about it and developed it well. If not, I find that currently a lot of games I'm playing, especially in third-person games, I'm just versing the same person over and over again. in every game I play. And you can even get to the point where it really just feels like, yeah, this is just the most basic AI, and I could just jump from one game to the next, and it just gets boring, and I don't feel like I'm doing anything. Definitely. Which is the biggest trouble I've had with some games recently, where a lot of people have raved about them, and I've played and I thought, oh, I've just killed this guy about 1,000 times in the last game I just played. Well, at least in this, even though the combat is a little bit clunky, the way it all comes together, it makes it unique.
Yeah.
And it's very...
It's so varied, and it's like you can play it your own way, the way that you want to play it. It reminds makes it really interesting.
One of the best games of the generation, which is Condemned, which again had basically the balls to step back and think, you know what? We've got this idea, and we're going to make the gameplay and the combat suit it. So a lot of that was melee. There's, you could only hold one gun at a time, and once the bullets run out, you just throw the gun, and you'd hardly come across anything. And that whole change around made such a big difference. And then, lo and behold, a few years later, they do the sequel, and it's just guns everywhere, and then by the time they've kind of got with the Fierce series as well, where they basically just ruined it with sequels. But I just really hope as they go into this new Bioshock Infinite as well, is that they keep the integrity of their design on the gameplay, and they don't have iron crosshairs and running around, which, by the looks of it, they're not going to do, but then I've avoided all of pretty much all of the videos and stuff, because there's been so much media for it recently.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a big problem with video games in general.
So let's come on to that topic. Let's talk about what we want to see preserved from this Bioshock in the new Bioshock Infinite, and what we think they should change. I think there's an interesting point to bring up of what you just talked about, Shane. in the new Bioshock, they've shown that when you shoot someone, a little number will pop up above their head like it does in Borderlands or something like that, which kind of is part of the RPG side of the game. Do you think that's a good change?
No.
Sitting on the fence.
Do you find that immersion breaking?
Yeah. It's pointless. In Borderlands, it makes sense, partly because it's cel-shaded, and I think if it wasn't cel-shaded and it had those numbers, it looks stupid. But I think it's part of the design. I almost think it's an accidental find on Gearbox's behalf. Yeah. Whereas they probably just did it and they were playing around with it. And when they cel-shaded everything, they thought, wait a minute, this actually looks quite good with all the colours. I don't think they really sat down and thought, yep, numbers above somebody's head are going to look great in a first-person shooter. I think it's something they just tried from RPGs, and because of the colours, it really worked. But especially in a single-player game, again, it comes back to something I've talked about before. Why do I need to see that?
What do the numbers represent?
Damage, I guess.
It's so not like.
I honestly don't know. They've shown it, and I think it's an option. I think you can turn it off.
I hope so.
But yeah, I don't know if there's any purpose behind it, any reason to it.
I don't think they'd implement it if there was no reason. You'd hope.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I think. Like, they're such a thoughtful developer. They seem to think about every element of their game. I would have thought there would be some reason behind it that it would make some sense.
I mean, hopefully, again, it's just something they've just displayed that maybe you can do. Or maybe it was part of the early multiplayer structure when they kind of had that idea bouncing around, and maybe they've scrapped that now. But I can't think of any system where you need to see the numbers. Like, even if it was the more red points that pop up, the more evil you become. Again, why do you need to see the mass in that? Why can't you just feel it as you play and see the changes within the game? And again, I just don't understand why you'd ever want to do that.
That's only a
I don't see the benefits.
It depends on the game. Like, if you're playing something like a JRPG,
but that is the grind, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. You really want to dive deep into the mechanics, into the whole statistical side of things.
Oh, no, that makes sense. Sure.
Part of the progression in the game is you actually wrapping your head around this. Like the numbers, wrapping your head around like how much damage you need to do to a certain enemy to kill them, because it's all about the strategy.
Yeah.
But Bioshock really wasn't that kind of game for me. It was about the feel of things. So yeah, it seems like a strange design decision, but I don't know. I've still got faith in Irrational that they've actually got some reason behind having that. And if it's optional, then it's optional. Then I can turn it off anyway.
Yeah. I think that's only a small. Very small part of it. I don't think it will represent the production of it. I do have high hopes, because I think everyone was a little bit let down with the repetition of ideas that went in Bioshock 2. I've got to say, I've not played it.
That wasn't them though, was it?
Was it not Irrational?
No, it was someone else.
It's a sequel. It went popular, so the publisher just farmed it off to another developer to...
I think it was 2K Marin, maybe? Yeah. I don't know.
It's basically like, in the 90s, it would have been an expansion pack. But they just thought, you know what, we'll just basically take everything, build some new levels, and do a new game out of it.
Mm. I mean, I've played Bioshock 2, and it's a really good game. It's not a bad game, but the thing is, when you have a game like Bioshock that is so different and full of so many ideas, that when you make a sequel to it that is just a typical video game sequel, bigger is better mentality, get a few new areas and some new enemy types, then it's not really good enough, if you will, because people have got that kind of expectation.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I think what's interesting about Infinite is that it's carrying the Bioshock name still, mm-hmm. and you can tell when you look at it, it's definitely got a Bioshock style. It carries over some of those ideas. It's got some big characters. It's about ideologies, but it's also an interesting shooter where you can kind of customize your own gameplay. But it's a completely different setting, still as fantastical as Rapture was. So like you're sitting in the sky, and it definitely looks like a Bioshock game, but it looks like a different game as well. It looks like a completely new experience.
I think they might have done themselves a bit of they might have caused themselves a little bit of a problem by calling it Bioshock. If they'd have just called it Infinite, everyone would have known it's related to Bioshock. But people are coming at it with such expectation, and that they'll be waiting for this grand idea. Because I am, you know, if it's just a straight shooter with plasmids or whatever the version of it is, everyone's going to hammer it. You know,
yeah. I can't see it just being a strange shooter with plasmids.
Oh well, no, it's not. But then, on you know, the flip side to that, it might go a little bit too far, and be like, right, well, we Bioshock had a great idea, so let's try and make an even better idea.
Try and come up with more ideas. Yeah, definitely. So, what do you? Is there anything particularly that you would want to see changed in Infinite? Anything mechanical? Anything story wise?
You mean from the original, as it were.
Ignoring Bioshock 2, just from the original Bioshock as an experience, anything, any element of that design that you think didn't really work and you would like to see changed. There's obviously the things that we've nitpicked on a bit, the hacking minigame. If you've got anything like that, they need to
change, like the hacking. I can't see that.
I think that'll just be gone.
Yeah, I agree. there'll be a much more fun version of it.
You hit something with a plasmid and it'll just take over the whole system, and then bots will flare out and help you out, for example.
There's an example.
That
could happen.
I just think as well, it's an assumption again, but I would feel that they would feel, well, maybe it's just developer pressure at the moment, but feel they need to streamline and take out a lot of stuff. So like you've just said, that whole hacking thing, if they're going down the route of having the AI, because it seems to be that you have a partner throughout the whole thing, which would be interesting to see how that pans out for the whole game.
There was a lot. Sorry, Karen.
No, go on.
I was just going to say there was a lot of talk about Elizabeth and what her role is going to be, and there's one of the worrying things was reading that at one point they were going to take her out altogether, and my concern there was if they'd be okay with taking out what we've been told is an essential part of the game. How important is she?
Yeah, because it seems to be the whole thing pivots on that. That to me, the way like the media and everything and the PR sold this is that she is the game and she is the point it exists for.
I mean, Ken Levine's talked about this quite a lot recently in a lot of recent articles and interviews. He's talked about the fact that some people on the development team wanted them to take Elizabeth out just because she was so much of a challenge to design. And he said, that's kind of similar to the way that lots of people wanted him to take out the big daddies and little sisters from the original game, because they were so hard to design, because they're not normal enemies. And Elizabeth clearly isn't a normal AI partner. They've tried to give her a personality and tried to make her interactions with the world, I don't know, interesting and different and varied, and make her seem more lifelike, if you will. If you watch some of the recent promotional material that's come out, lots of it focuses on what Elizabeth can do in her environments and how random it is, and how it's the small incidental details about how she reacts to things that really breathe life into a character. Yeah. So I think I've got like a lot of anticipation there about what they're doing, and I think Elizabeth is kind of their kind of little sister, big daddy kind of AI thing for this game. So like the Big Daddy and Little Sister and that whole ecosystem that they built where they would just go about their own, doing their own thing, and they had that relationship. This is kind of their equivalent in Infinite, kind of like another step forward in technological video game design that hasn't really been done before. I suppose you could argue it has in Half-Life 2 with Alex Vance. So they're trying to do something similar to that.
I wonder if she'll be in the whole thing throughout, because that would majorly affect the way they design the game, because there'd be no more hubs or side areas, because there'd always be the risk that she'd get stuck on a door or on a ledge and just be running on the spot. And
it's a good point.
Unless they do really clever, like really clever AI design, which may be why they've been pushing it back so much, because they've been doing that from scratch.
Yeah.
And if they come out and she's like, throughout the whole game, it's pretty much flawless. I mean, you're always going to get a few hiccups, but pretty much throughout flawless, then that would be incredible. And that's kind of, again, this high hopes, it's this expectations that if anyone's going to do it, it'd be developers such as themselves or others of their class, where they have that freedom to...
Yeah, to experiment to with do that, kind of thing.
Which I hope they nail it. And if it's just a case of they've stripped everything down and it's really straightforward to stop her clipping into walls and things, or... She's with you, and then for the middle part of the game, they haven't talked about she gets kidnapped, so then they can open the world up, because it's the only way they could think of doing it.
I'll bet there's some sequence like that, but we won't get into predictions.
That's a good point. I think it would seem... I'd feel like it was quite a cheap option having her there to be protected and at one point saved. And I just couldn't think of anything worse to do with a character who's going to be with you the whole way, for her to be, you know, not useless per se, but I've not seen her, you know, in like a combat situation. I've not seen her with a gun fighting the way like.
Oh, it's been shown that she does. I've watched more than I intended to. I think I said on this podcast that I'm going to avoid all promotional material for Bioshock, which I have completely failed in. And I've watched something recently that was like an interview that focused upon Elizabeth, and it showed you her in a combat situation where she kind of like runs around and she'll throw you guns and things, and then she can handle a gun herself, and she'll support you, she'll throw you ammo when you need it, and she'll highlight where she can do these tears in the world that you can tell her to go and do. So she's kind of like, she's not just a wooden stick that stands there and cowers behind you. She actually does interact with the world, it looks like.
There's so much written about other characters in games, and it's a bit unfair to say, but it is usually a female character. Like, I can't remember her name, but the president's daughter in Resident Evil 4.
Ashley Williams?
That's her. Something like that. I can tell you've got history. Who just, they just drove me around the bend by the end, because they just constantly needed babysitting. And
They're not really a character in and of themselves. They're just there to be a hindrance to gameplay.
Basically. But not like Ico, where the whole game was based on... I mean, that was the whole game.
That was the point of the game, wasn't it?
And it was well implemented.
Definitely.
And it had a sense of panic around it. But just when you've got someone walking behind you who's got a crosshair on their forehead, and it's like, all right, well, I'd like to be expressive, but I can't because you're behind me, and you just grow to hate them. So I'm sure she won't become that. But if she did, I'd not. Just it would kill it.
Sure, I think I just had a quick idea, and again, they're probably not going to do it. And again, I know nothing about the game because I've been avoiding it. But I think it'd be amazing for a game like this or another game, especially with, you know, everything being discussed in this media at the moment, where if, for example, you got to like the last quarter of the game, and as playing as the main male character, you die, and then it actually transfers over to the other character. So if you're trying to be the way it kind of pans around that she ends up being the hero more than you, or it switches around where she has to protect him and you take over control of her for the last quarter of the game, you know, because they're the sort of team again that might play on that idea of, especially how they've dressed her up, which I'm guessing is going to play into it, of kind of being that kind of Elizabethan kind of passive sort of girl. And if they keep that same thing we're talking about before in Bioshock, a very clever, subtle kind of, they're asking the questions without breaking the fourth wall. I hope they keep with those, which I'm sure they will.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's end this by, choosing, and I know Shane loves it when I do these kind of endings. So let's choose one thing that you're most anticipating about BioShock Infinite, one thing you're most looking forward to, one thing you're most worried about, and then give a prediction about what you think the story is going to be, how you think the story is going to twist. So I'll kick things off with mine. So my one thing that I'm most looking forward to is probably just the world, seeing how they build something that's kind of equivalent to Rapture and seeing how they make that environment interesting. Because it seems like a very different environment. It's very open, very airy. So I'm just wondering how they keep kind of like, I don't know, the kind of the
claustrophobic.
No, because it's clearly not claustrophobic, but keep it engrossing as an environment. How'd they keep you're like interested in that environment? So that's probably my most anticipated thing. The thing I'm most worried about is probably combat, because I don't get a good feeling with the whole numbers slashing up over the head kind of thing. I think they might have struggled because obviously they got quite a bit of criticism after BioShock about the combat being clunky, which I didn't really have that much of a problem with. So I'm hoping they haven't changed it too much. And then my story prediction, I think that at some point in the game, you're going to come into Rapture and that's going to be part of a big twist. You're going to come into Rapture through one of Elizabeth's tears, I should say, sorry.
Right.
Oh, that'll be pretty good.
Yeah, that's. You should work that into DLC, I think.
No. Oh, God. Anyway, should I do mine?
Yeah, go on, yeah.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. So the main thing for me is going to be the philosophy and the idea of them asking questions. That's the one thing I'm looking forward to seeing the most. If it's still a bit clunky in the gameplay, I'm not bothered about that as long as it's actually interesting to play and it doesn't just play like everything else that's just spilling out. Especially as we get towards the end of this generation and, you know, new consoles are finally going to come out. Which, is, again, we're going to come around to the cycle of the games, especially come like cross-platform games, which seems a bit weird. I'd like this to be kind of a push. So people will look at this and go, actually, this is good story writing. You know, the medium can stand up on its two feet when it wants to do things like this. You just need to give the teams a space to do the work they need to do. So I'm really looking forward to that. My concerns are going to be whether they can really achieve that and whether they're going to feel pressure to streamline everything. Now, you might think that they won't have any publisher pressure, but after the box art, which they're trying to sell it as making it look like everything else, which is this guy there, like, tattered clothes, rugged, kind of typical American good-looking guy with a sawn-off shotgun.
Yeah.
Which, again, seems to go against everything the game's supposed to be about. And I won't be surprised if there's just an American flag waving somewhere in the background or something. which in the game was probably going to be ironic, but on the box art, it doesn't work. It's a flat image. And after them saying that, you know, so many ideas were cut out because they didn't feel necessary or it might weaken it, and then to turn around and start selling a season pass pre-order or whatever it is, or talk about the fact there's going to be DLC already, I just think, well, if, you know, there's clearly a lot of pressure. Maybe there's more pressure they've ever had. And that behind the scenes, that's been affecting it. Maybe there's been delays because they want day one DLC or DLC every month afterwards to extend the story. For example, in Dead Space 3, apparently the DLC that's just come out actually carries on from the ending and actually adds more to the plot.
It's shocking.
That should have been pretty much there. They haven't even talked about it like that. They've just said, oh yeah, new DLC that you can experience and have fun with. And people have played it, reviewed it and gone, yeah, there's actually... It carries on directly from the ending.
That's holding,
and it's pretty integral.
That's holding the game ransom. That's not DLC.
Yep.
Shocking.
So I expect the same here. Because they've already said they're going to do it. So I can't see any way that they're not going to make it part of the story. We've already had DLC where they've actually sold the ending of a game as DLC. I don't think it would be that extreme. But to say they're going to have three or four pieces of DLC after scrapping multiplayer, and to not have it affect the story, no. Unless the only way it would be good... is if Half-Life expansions, where they take a character out of it and you play as them within a smaller part, maybe they walk off somewhere
and you
for
get
half the game and you get to play that arc.
Yeah, you get a different perspective on
that
events.
Stuff
that's
good,
cool.
But again...
I mean, I think I haven't played it myself, but people always praise Minerva's Den DLC. I think that was DLC for Bioshock 2, was it?
I never played it.
You said it was a really good piece of DLC. I don't know. I can't tell you details around it. I think it was just an extra piece of the game that you could go to whilst you were playing the game, or you could go back to if you'd finished the game.
It's
doing that with
my concern.
Dishonored, aren't they? That you play as a character who is in the game a little bit, and then he goes away and comes back, and I think he gets killed by Corvo. He was one of the assassins at the start, and you play as him in the intervening days between his...
Yeah, you see what he was up to, yeah.
Uh-huh.
I think that's quite interesting, where like the DLC adds to the story but doesn't necessarily change the main arc of the story. Like the main arc is a singular vision that you get when you buy the game, but then you can get something that gives you a slightly different perspective. That's quite an interesting way to do DLC.
So my main concern, really, to summarize it, is that I wanted this to be a singular great narrative experience, and then to announce DLC before it's even out is a massive concern, especially with the way things are going. I know that's probably the business side, but again, it's going to have a detriment somewhere. And prediction, I'll go with what I just said before, that the player control will flip around at some point.
Okay.
Richard?
That'll do mine. What was the first one again, sorry?
Thing that you're
most looking forward to.
Most looking forward to, thing that you're most worried about, and then prediction.
Okay, I think the thing I'm looking forward to, I think hopefully they've really thought about the story, because it was the best, the story and the actual city itself, because it was the best thing about BioShock. And I hope that they've really thought about it. Not tried to emulate the whole feel of Rapture, but try to do something new and special. And I thought the combat was good in the first one, so I've not really got a huge amount of concern about it. So hopefully that it will not be reliant on combat in so much as if it's terrible, well, not terrible, but if it's poorer than you'd expect, you'd still want to progress because the story was that good. I think that's important. With a game such as this, I mean, the BioShock franchise is kind of vaulted by its story. So hopefully they've worked hard and they've produced something worth playing, story wise. My concern obviously is that they haven't, and that they've bowed to pressure because they know that this is going to be a good game. And the idea that, they make something that is more mass marketable, because I wouldn't have said BioShock is the original is a mass marketable game. I think it's quite niche, and I think it was lucky, to be honest with you, because the market, you still don't see many games like BioShock around, and I do feel it is quite a flash in the pan. Its success, it's deserved success. But I think on paper, I imagine that them pitching the idea of BioShock would have been quite a challenge to publishers. Yeah. And I think they got lucky. I think the stars aligned with them. It was brilliant, but I mean, it could have just been terrible. I do remember seeing early you know, screenshots and early previews of it, and just thinking it just looked bloody awful. It's just a shoot 'em up under the sea. I mean, I was completely wrong, obviously. So hopefully they haven't bowed to some of the pressure and just gone, right, well, let's do more of the same. I want them to take a massive, massive risk, because that's what the first one was, and I think that's what this one should be. So that's my hope and concern. I think shock ending, I don't know, as long as or twist or whatever, I don't really know, but as long as there is one, or not so much a twist, but there is something more that says more about ourselves and about video games and humanity, which what the first one did. As long as it's more than a game, as long as it's more than the sum of its parts. Other than that, if it gave a code at the end that I could use to get a free t-shirt, I would love that. And also, I don't know. Yeah, that's what I'm going to go for. I want a t-shirt. I want a fucking t-shirt. I survived the Columbia experience.
The collapse of Columbia. Yeah.
So, Ken, I know you listen. I'm an extra large. I want that t-shirt.
Brilliant. Okay, have you got a narrative prediction as well?
Narrative prediction.
Story prediction.
Oh, man. It was his sledge. No, I don't know.
It was a...
I don't know. It's, I've been avoiding as much information as I can, to be honest with you. I've read a couple of previews in a couple of magazines, but I have kind of been avoiding it, so I don't think it would be fair to say. As long as I really hope they use Elizabeth really well. I was shocked when I heard that they might have been removing her, because that made her feel less valuable. So I hope that she is crucial to the end game, and I'm sure she will be, and I'm sure they'll do a really good job. And I don't think she'll just be a target that you've got to protect. I think the team behind it is smarter than that. So I've really high hopes for it. I really do. I can't give a narrative. If I could do that, I'd be irrational. But
oh, you've given one. Your prediction is that Elizabeth will be a brilliant piece of video game design.
That's what.
No, she's a sleigh.
And that she's also a sledge.
Possibly called Rosebud. Who knows? Who knows?
All right, guys, that's it for our return to Rapture. If you want to let us know what your thoughts on Bioshock and the upcoming Infinite are, would you kindly head on over to thunderboltgames.com and check out the forums, or alternatively, contact us on Twitter @_thunderbolt or email us at podcast@thunderboltgames.com. From me, it's goodbye. From Shane.
Goodbye.
And from Richard.
Bye-bye.